Stephen Vladeck from the who's our Supreme Court Justice, Supreme Court aficionado. Stephen, how are you?
I'm good, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing well. Are you still in Israel?
No, actually, I got back this weekend.
All right. Do you have a good trip?
Yeah, it was great.
Did you feel safe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's been really 5 or 6 years now since there was, you know, random violence, especially violence against tourists in Israel. So I think, you know, for all the concerns people have, it's a pretty good time to visit.
Tell us what you were doing there.
Well, my law school, American University here in D.C., we have a summer program there where we send about 15 American law students, about half from our school and half from others, to go take courses with Israeli instructors and to learn about, you know, a different legal system and different legal issues. And I'm there basically just to supervise, you know, help them see the comparisons between U.S. and Israel, and ultimately give them an exam. So it was a lot of fun.
The differences between law there and here in the United States.
Indeed. I mean, there's, you know, the biggest one is Israel actually doesn't have a written constitution. So, you know, we talk all the time, especially you and I, you know, about constitutional law in the United States. Israel has an entire legal system without a constitution. And so it's interesting to see what kind of effect that has on issues like minority rights, on issues like national security and so on.
How does that work for them?
Well, you know, the Israeli legislature, the Knesset, does most everything by statute, and there's just a consensus that some statutes are more important than others. They call them basic laws, and the basic laws, you know, serve at least functionally kind of like constitutional rights, with the one big difference that they can be repealed if there's a majority of the legislature that wants to repeal it. But until and unless they're repealed, you know, those are sort of the quasi-constitutional documents that they have.
Well, let's talk about several topics. And you and I talked last week, but more decisions were rendered from the Supreme Court. And the biggie was with video games and kids, and that will affect a lot of folks.
Yeah, I mean, so this was a case that we were all waiting for. On Monday, the Supreme Court affirmed the Ninth Circuit, that's the Federal Appeals Court in California, affirmed their decision that struck down a California law banning the sale of violent video games to minors. And basically, the Supreme Court said, you know, as problematic, as troublesome as it is to have minors playing these, you know, incredibly violent video games, it really crosses the First Amendment line for the state to, you know, categorically ban the sale or rental of these games. The big thesis being that, you know, unlike obscenity and pornography, violence is something that's sort of all over the place. It's in the Bible, it's in, you know, fairy tales, it's in literature. And, you know, the court was reluctant to say that states can take the same measures vis-a-vis violence that they can do with regard to obscenity and pornography.
And so this will affect not only the labeling, but how these video games are distributed.
That's right. I mean, I think the real implication of Monday's decision is that it's going to be very, very difficult for states to impose anything but the most specific constraints on the sale and distribution of even the most, you know, gratuitously violent video games. That, you know, if the only thing the state is worried about is violence, it has to do something more than just categorically ban the sale of violent materials to juveniles.
Wanted to talk to you about the Supreme Court ruling that changes the calculation of foreign ownership stakes in local public utilities, and they used the term economic suicide.
Yeah, you know, the court seems to be on this kick of sort of, you know, deciding that it knows better than everybody else, you know, what's best for consumers. It's interesting that the court would use such a sort of headline-grabbing term, but I think the idea behind it is that, you know, it's not necessarily the best idea to allow, you know, massive and sort of unchecked public foreign ownership of our public utilities, you know, lest we become beholden to all those foreign owners for reliance on, you know, our most basic social services.
I had several emails from viewers who wanted me to ask you again about the Supreme Court's Walmart decision. They weren't quite clear and they didn't catch all of our interview, but that's a big, big ruling, and the split was typical in what seems to be a split in a lot of decisions.
Yeah, so I mean, the Walmart case, which came out last week, you know, the short version is that the Supreme Court said There cannot be a nationwide class action where every single female employee of Walmart, you know, brings the same lawsuit on the ground that Walmart is engaged in this structural pattern of wage discrimination against women. The real sort of analytical hook is that the court basically said there's too much variation. You know, there are too many different scenarios behind this claim. So women who are discriminated against at Walmart stores in Michigan, even at particular Walmart stores, might have different claims against their supervisors than women who were discriminated against by Walmart, you know, by Walmart in California, and so on and so forth. So, you know, what the court really said is that it's going to be very difficult to bring any kind of nationwide class action against Walmart or any other company if what you're really alleging is lots of different violations in lots of different places by lots of different employees of the same company. You know, that's the real, I think, key to the decision, and that's where the justices split insofar as what it's going to mean going forward, with the conservatives basically suggesting that none of these lawsuits should ever be able to go forward, and the more liberal justices saying this one shouldn't go forward, but maybe some others should.
We're talking with Professor of Law at American University's Washington College of Law, Stephen Vladeck. Stephen, any other decisions that I missed that will affect a lot of people?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the court's been doing a lot with campaign finance lately, and, you know, I think it's hard for us to get our head around these cases because they're so technical. But there's a big one that came out on Monday in a case out of Arizona. Arizona has a matching scheme for public financing of elections, and the short version is that, you know, Arizona doesn't limit contributions to candidates. But, Tony, if you were not taking public money, and if I was, and if we were running against each other, the way the Arizona scheme works is for every private contribution you get, I'm entitled to more public money. And what the Supreme Court said on Monday is that's unconstitutional, that violates the First Amendment rights of the people who are contributing to you, because it is basically meaning that the state has to in turn subsidize my campaign because of their private choice to contribute. It sounds a little technical, but it's going to matter a lot for those states like Arizona that have pursued public financing of elections, and it's going to make it very hard for those states to keep doing that going forward. I think we're just going to see more and more private money dominating elections at even the most local level.
The Supreme Court has added a couple of high-profile constitutional challenges to its lineup of cases for next term. One looks at governmental regulations of TV content, and the other with the authority of police to use a GPS device to track a suspect's movements without a warrant.
Yeah, these are two of the big cases on the docket for next fall. The first is called FCC versus Fox, and the basic question is, you know, can the federal government basically penalize, you know, these broadcasters for what are called fleeting expletives? So when we're watching a live broadcast of a sports game or of a news broadcast, and there's a sort of unscripted curse word, should the broadcaster be subjected to extremely heavy fines? Or is there a First Amendment protection for even, you know, the seven words you can't say on television? That's the question in FCC versus Fox. The GPS case is really interesting. The question there is, you know, more and more police precincts throughout the country have been using GPS tracking devices to keep track of suspects, to, you know, follow suspected criminals, et cetera. And so far, the courts that have reached the issue have said it is not actually a search for Fourth Amendment purposes when the government puts a GPS tracker on your car, because they could do the same thing by just following you around. And if it's not a search, that means that the government doesn't have to get a warrant before it puts a GPS tracker on your car. So the question the court's going to hear next term is whether that's in fact true, or whether the government actually does have to go get a warrant from a neutral magistrate before it does something like, you know, putting that kind of device on your car. It's a really big issue. It's one that I think is really the forefront of the next generation of constitutional law with regard to how technology affects our privacy rights. And we'll see what the court has to say about that in the fall.
Stephen Vladeck is the Supreme Court expert for us. He's a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. As always, Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tony.